Okay, it's good to welcome all of you here today, and for me to be back is good. My brother's last wedding took place. He has five children, and the fifth of those was married. The highlight of the wedding was when a woman came up to me, looked at my tie. I deliberately wore the same tie. It has zebras on it. Points to the tie and says, "Did you know zebras can mate with horses?" And I said, "No, I did not." "What do you call such a mating?" And she says, "Zorse." I've never heard of that before, but I'll just pass that piece of information. I will tell you for what it's worth, it got more strange after that. And if you want to hear the rest of it, you can ask me afterwards. I won't take the time now. This is a magic and special day. We are starting a new book. So, you know what your job is, right? Read the book. I want you to read the entire book of Exodus. So that any time I want to pick and choose across the whole of the book, things to talk about, things to link together, that you'll be ready to go. I especially would like for you to read the first 18 chapters. The pastor is going to be talking, and those in small groups on the Ten Commandments will be talking and working from chapter 19 on. I'd like you to read the first 18 chapters so that you've got a good solid run-up, a context in which to understand the things you'll be looking at in those. And we will, in our turn, get to those soon enough. So, I would like for you to remind yourselves of what happened at the end of Genesis. The last verse of Genesis tells you what? Last verse of Genesis tells you what? Joseph died and was embalmed and buried in a coffin in Egypt, having given orders, having given instructions, having given requests to the people that at some point they get his body back up and bury him with Abraham and Isaac and Jacob in the tombs up in Cana. Now, if you'll take a look at how Exodus starts, Exodus seems to start by backing up a bit into Genesis, because what he does is he begins to talk about Israel or Jacob going down to Egypt and listing the sons that went with him. The point of this is to give you a sense of how big the family was. The resulting translations of this part of Scripture invite you to a little bit of confusion, and in some places it says in verse 5 that the total number of people in Jacob's family was 70. Some translations it says the descendants of Jacob were 70, which invites you to maybe think the family was a little bigger, so that those translations that say 75, maybe there's not the discrepancy that it looks like. But he names the sons that went with him. There's 11 names there. Mentions that Joseph was already in Egypt. And then it says in verse 7, Joseph died and his brothers and all that generation. But the Israelites were fruitful and prolific. They became so numerous and powerful that eventually the whole of that land was full of them. Let's go back and just consider this just a little bit. Mine says fruitful and prolific at the front end of verse 7. Does yours have those same two words? I doubt it. What words? Exceedingly numerous. Some will say multiplied greatly. Some will say exceedingly numerous. Mine says fruitful and prolific. I like that.
Well, population explosion.
Mm-hmm. And then it says in mine, they became so numerous, and then it adds another word. They're not just numerous. What else are they? Mine says powerful. What does that imply that they used to be? Weak and powerless and small in number. They started out at about 70 or 75. Remember when Esau came up to meet Jacob as he was coming back into the country? How many armed men did Esau have with him? You remember this? 400. 400. They number 75. They're weak and they're small in number. But fairly quickly, after Joseph dies, after all that generation dies, something is happening. They're increasing in number and they're increasing, it says, in power. And it says eventually the whole land was full of them. What land is that?
Egypt.
No. Probably not Egypt. Probably that section of Egypt that we would call Goshen. Where is Goshen?
Northeast of
north and east. Where would north and east, actually it's still in Egypt, so you can't say north and east of Egypt, but in the north and east part of Egypt. If you remember, the Nile River flows in which direction? It flows from the south to the north, out of the mountains and the edge of Ethiopia, and it flows down into the Mediterranean Sea. So it flows north into the Mediterranean Sea. As it gets close to the sea, you have the Nile Delta, so it fans out, and Goshen is in sort of the eastern side. So it's the north and eastern portion. And the picture is they fill all of that land. Verse 8 is stunning. In my translation, it reads, then. Then means after all those things that have just been summarized in verses 1 through 7, now or then. There came to power. Yours says eventually. Yours says eventually. There came to power in Egypt a new king. What's the title for the kings in Pharaoh, in Egypt? Pharaoh. So they're using the term king and Pharaoh back and forth. Genesis has been doing that. They're doing that here as well. There came to power in Egypt a new king, and my translation says he had never heard of Joseph. Yours says he did not know Joseph. A few translations have an extra phrase in there. Didn't know Joseph and didn't know anything about what he had done. King James says, who knew not Joseph. How could you not know about Joseph? Well, my friend is suggesting the southern and northern was split. Another was saying ignorance. Was that your suggestion? There's a couple of old commentators that you guys ought to know about. There's a Matthew Henry, a guy named Matthew Henry. He's got, I don't know, 21, 22, 23 volumes of his commentary. But, thank goodness, somebody has given you the condensed Matthew Henry, which is all in one book. And if you look carefully, you can find this online and find it linked into things so that you can look at it quickly. If you want your own copy, go get it from a bookstore that's still in print. And the second is a guy named Gill. Gill is a little less politically correct in places, but these two fellows, I think, enough difference in time that they're not monolithic, but they have interesting things to say sometimes. I'm going to pick today to tell you a little bit about what Gill said. Could the king have known Joseph the person? And the answer is probably not. Now, there's a clue a little bit later, and then there's big, bold statements later. How much time went by between verse 7 and verse 8? Roughly how long went by? Okay. Probably 300 to 350 years. Maybe a little longer than that. Because Moses is coming. Moses is coming. Moses is coming in chapter 3. And by the time Moses comes, a whole bunch of stuff is set in place. It then takes how long before Moses comes back into the country? I'm assuming you've read all of Exodus. Are you noticing this? Are you noticing this? The thrust here is what God does through his servant Moses. Moses comes in chapter 3, and by the time the book of Exodus is over, the people have experienced an Exodus. Yeah, yeah, thank you. Thank you. I want to make sure you know what the term of the book means. Thank you. Thank you. Right? They have experienced an Exodus, which Moses has led. Roughly how old was Moses when he came back in to lead them out? He was roughly 80. So, you know, Moses hasn't been born yet, so there's some time before that. But the total period of time between the time that they came into Egypt and the time they went out as the Exodus started, most people look at the Bible record and say that's about 430 years. So back up at least 80 years from that, that's 350, and probably more like 300, 250 to 300 years, something like that is what we're looking at. Okay? I don't think we need to be exact, but enough time has gone by that the chance to know who Joseph was in person, to have known that as a person you could speak to and so forth, that would not have been possible. But Gill adds, he could hardly have been ignorant of the history. That 7 years of famine put a mark on that place that would have lasted for centuries. So he could hardly have been ignorant of history. So what does it mean? What does that word, he didn't know Joseph. Gill says he would unpack it like this. He had no regard for Joseph or what he had done for Egypt. He acknowledged no obligation of Egypt to Joseph's descendants or to Joseph's people. That is, to Joseph's specific family or to the larger family, the larger group, people group of which Joseph was part. He acknowledged no obligation to Egypt. And Gill then goes on to say, and this is the crucial one, he saw Joseph's people as an active threat, not as a distant blessing. That's a good way of phrasing it. There's a shift from seeing Joseph as someone who has blessed Egypt by his presence, has preserved Egypt when many civilizations would have fallen under that famine. They don't see him as someone to whom gratitude and appreciation should be given. They see his people as an active threat. Why are they an active threat? Go back up into verses 1 through 7. What does it say? They are growing by leaps and bounds. And they are becoming more and more powerful. May I take a time out? What's happening in the U.S.? What's happening in Europe right now?
Change in population.
There is shifts in population. Some people groups are growing by multiplying faster than others. Others are hardly multiplying at all. And we are going to experience something like this. What we do about it, I don't know. The future is not mine to see. But we are experiencing something of what they're experiencing. And it would be interesting, I think, if only to look at the reaction of the people of Egypt to this. There came to power in Egypt a new king who had never heard of Joseph. Can I take you for a moment to the book of Judges? Why are you taking us to the book of Judges, you ask? Well, wait and see, he said. I will try. He saw this people group as an active threat, not as a distant blessing. If you'll go to Judges chapter 2. Now, as you're going there, I want you to notice the book that is immediately before Judges. Who knows if we will ever get to these two books, but someday we might. Okay? What's the book immediately before Judges? And who is Joshua? Joshua was the one who actually led the people into the promised land. Moses was not allowed to do that. Joshua is the one who did that. And the book of Joshua talks about the people entering the promised land and taking over the land and fulfilling God's promise of you will have this land. Okay? I want to start at verse 6 of Judges chapter 2. Joshua, having dismissed the people, the Israelites then went away, each one to his own heritage to occupy the country. The people served the Lord throughout the lifetime of Joshua and throughout the lifetime of those elders who outlived Joshua, those elders who had known all the great deeds which the Lord had done for the sake of Israel. Joshua, the son of Nun, was 110 years old when he died, buried on the estate he had received as his heritage. Verse 10, and when that whole generation had been gathered to its ancestors, another followed it, which... And there is an almost perfect parallel to Exodus 1:8. A generation arose which neither knew the Lord nor the deeds which he had done for the sake of Israel. What is the obvious question to ask? Why did they not know? Why did they not know? Gill is suggesting maybe they did know, they didn't care. Maybe they did know, but they had decided that wasn't an important thing to know, and they were going to put something else in its place. Interesting thoughts.
I was going to say this a while ago about Joseph, but it's the same thing today. That's what they're teaching. They're not teaching history in high schools and so forth now, going back to the, you know, our past history. So it's very similar, you know, today to what happened in these days. Isn't that learning the history of the U.S.?
I think we'll not step on that particular... Have you been to the 8 o'clock service today? Remember talking about landmines?
Yes.
Okay. Have any of you come into the church this morning through the back doors that face Choctaw? We have a minefield out on that side of the church. Are you aware of this? About 100 geese have chosen to take up residence in the space between us and the bank and that little professional office there. And it is difficult to find places to place your feet without stepping in something. I don't suggest your comment matches up with goose poop, but I think there is a little bit of a landmine in that area to debate or discuss, and let's leave that for another time. But yeah, somehow people are not picking up on what God is saying. People are not picking up on how God has blessed this place. I think there is a pretty good debate that could be had about how accurate the history is that was taught before. I commend to you a book. I forget the name of it. I'm halfway through reading it and I don't remember the name. Isn't that something? But basically it's a story about the things the history teachers have taught us and the things they've gotten wrong. There's a big section on the Cherokee, which is where I grew up. And I read that section with great interest. But here it is. Parallel over in Judges, that's not the only place that the Bible has this, but this is sort of the big two. Hey, good morning. So here we are. A new king came to power who, my translation said, had never heard of Joseph. Maybe Gil is right. Maybe there's a little bit more to it. But whatever the case, he now takes a look at these people, and without the filter of gratitude, without the filter of appreciation for what Joseph has done, what does he see? Start at verse 9. Look, he said to his people. Look implies, I've already looked, you look too. Tell me what you see. And I'd like to get a list here. I think there's 4 points that he makes. Look, he says. Number 1, are you reading through here? Okay. Read down to about verse 10. So it's verse 8, verse 9, verse 10. Sorry, even better than that, just verse 9 and 10. Number 1, what's the first point he makes? They are more numerous than we are. That's about to happen in some parts of Europe. That's about to happen in some parts of the U.S. Shifts in population. What had been the majority is they are more numerous than we are. That's point 1. That would be bad enough. What's point 2? They're stronger than we. They're more numerous than we are, and they're stronger than we are. So what's his point? We better have a plan to stop them from growing even more. And if we don't, and war breaks out, they're liable to join our enemies and fight against us. And depending on the translation, the last little phrase of verse 10, my translation says, escape from the country. Well, if they're too numerous and you don't want them to be there, letting them escape sounds like a pretty good thing. There's translators who say that it may look like it sounds that, but it's more likely it means take over the country. So let's review. They outnumber us. They're more powerful than we are. If we don't get a plan to stop them from growing even more, we're going to be in trouble. Because if we don't stop them from growing any more, and this thing gets a whole lot worse, if any enemy ever comes, we've got a potential internal enemy. We have got to put a stop to this right now. We've got to stop them from growing, and we've got to weaken them. Verse 11, what did they do? My translation, the first word of verse 11 is accordingly. Yours may say therefore or so or somewhere like that. So here's our premise, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. And now we start to take action. Accordingly, what did they do? They pull them into slavery, and they put, my translation says, taskmasters. I think there's one translation that says brutal slave drivers. You may have that translation. And what's the purpose? What's the purpose? My translation says to wear them down by forced labor. And then the rest of verse 11, in this way they built the store cities, S-T-O-R-E, store cities. These are not cities where things are sold. These are cities where things are stored. Something like the cities Joseph built, which is a very interesting parallel. Joseph built these places all over the country to store the surplus in the good years. They're building those. What are the names of those two cities?
Pithom
and Ramses. There's a number of places you can go to sort of figure out how those names came to be. There is a particularly interesting place. It's in the Digital Library of the University of Pennsylvania. There is a woman who was active in the Egyptian Exploration Fund. This was the group that put money together to study by archaeological digs and one sort or another what was in Egypt. And she was a major factor. The males, after about 20 years or 30 years, finally took over and removed her from her position of influence. But she wrote of her travels, and she wrote of what the archaeologists were learned. She was basically one of the big sources of funding for this thing, and so she traveled in the area in the late 1800s, 1870s, 1880s. She wrote a couple of books about this. The books are online at the University of Pennsylvania Digital Library. You can read what she wrote. I don't remember. I didn't know. Edwards, I think. Maybe it's an ancestry. In any event, she writes that at one place they found a big... Have you seen the Department of Transportation in Virginia stockpiles salt to use on the roads, right? If you just put a big pile of salt in a parking lot and it rains, what happens? It all melts. It all dissolves, right? So what do you do with the salt? And mostly they seem to be doing this with the sand and the gravel and all that as well. What do they do? Yeah, what does it look like?
Looks like a missile silo.
Well, missile silos would be a little bit thinner and a little bit taller. What does it look like? Looks like a beehive. Right? It kind of looks like a beehive. It actually has a little corrugation on the outside that looks like that. Right? That's what they say they found. And in this sort of beehive-like area, they saw the remnants of things that had been stored in these places. And what they found was the lowest courses of brick, maybe up 3 feet, the bricks had little pieces of straw chopped up in it. And then the next few courses of bricks, it had little pieces of reeds like you might go find on the banks of the Nile River. It was all Nile mud, but it had straw. And then the top few courses, it was nothing but mud. And her comment was, those of us who know something of the Bible find this interesting. I can't speak to the validity of this, except the University of Pennsylvania is a little different from it, if there were another source on the internet with this kind of thing in it. Okay? You have to have read all of Exodus to understand the difference in the bricks, but maybe some of you have read Exodus before and have some sense of it. So that's their task. Now, let's see what the result was. Verse 12. Mine has the word but leading off that verse. Does yours?
Yep.
But here's our plan. We will grind them down with forced labor to the point that they won't have any energy to reproduce. How did that go? Have you read verse 12? How did that go? The harder their lives were made, the more they increased. I assume that means in number, but it could mean in power and number both. And spread until the people came to fear the Israelites. I think they were doing this, you get the impression they were doing this without really knowing that it was a good thing to do. And the king's afraid, you know, maybe we shouldn't be, but hey, it's kind of fun to have slaves and all this kind of stuff, so off we go. And all of a sudden, they began to fear. Who are the people who fear the Israelites? Does yours define those people? Mine just says, the people came to fear the Israelites. I'm looking at the tail end, but I think it's verse 12.
Egyptians.
That's the Egyptian people, right? Verse 13, mine starts with so. You got a therefore, you got a but, then you have a so. Yours has an and. So what happened? Mine says the Egyptians gave them no mercy in the demands they made, making their lives miserable. Miserable is the translation that mine uses. What translations does yours use? Because it's a very important word. Bitter. If you know something about Jewish ceremonies around Passover, I understand that word shows up big time in the experience. Bitterness. Mine says miserable, but the word bitter has, I think, a larger context, and I commend that to you.
repel the son of the
rigorously.
Rigorously, yours says. Okay. Now, mine says, made their lives miserable with hard labor, and then there's a colon. That's the little symbol that has two dots, right? Mm-hmm. You can put that, and then you can put another symbol. It looks like you're smiling and emoticons that you use on your mind. Right. Hope you send your email to the right place. That was funny, Alice. What were they doing at this hard labor? Mine has one, two, three things that is listed. Bricks is the second one. You missed the first one. What's the first one? Okay, some people say clay, but there's another word that's being used. And I heard somebody say it over in here. They were mixing mortar or digging clay or mixing mortar. But the idea of mortar, and then what's the second one? Making bricks. Okay, you know something about how to make bricks? You basically pack mud into a mold and then either heat it or let the sun heat it until the moisture content changes, and all kinds of wonderful chemical reactions take place where the sulfates and the phosphates and the silicates are all linking and cross-linking and making something. You all do know about brick making and concrete, right? You know about... Okay. And what's the third one? We are not going to feed you while you do this. You have to feed yourselves. You want to eat. You go grow your own food, and we're going to take a tax out of that food. Mine has three things. Mine says digging clay, which I think is the word mortar is maybe a better one. And it's a better one because that same woman that was talking about this says, really interesting, you look all over Egypt, and what you see is bricks put in place with mud in between the bricks. Here's this one city, and these bricks that we're talking about, they've got mortar in between. That's kind of unusual for Egypt, she said. And then she said, but those of us who know the Bible, this is interesting. I just mention that. All sorts of labor that they imposed on them without mercy. Verse 13 starts with no mercy. Verse 14 ends with no mercy. Okay? What was the problem? They're more numerous than us. They're more powerful than us. If we don't do something to stop their growth, then if war comes, they're going to choose the other side, and we're going to be doomed. So, what's our solution? We're going to put them into forced labor. We're going to put them into slavery. And we're going to treat them so miserably, they won't have the energy to reproduce anymore. And it didn't work. Verse 15, things get really grim. What's the next stage? He calls in the midwives. Just to make sure that everybody knows what we're talking about. Who are midwives? People who assist in births. Okay? Do we have midwives in Virginia today?
Yes.
You bet. Yes. Is there a procedure for making sure that they know what they're doing?
Yes.
Yes. They are certified or licensed. Okay? How many midwives serve Virginia? Great question, right? How many midwives served here? I don't think so. Two are mentioned. Probably who are these two? They're the head midwives. I think you don't know, but I think what's happening is there's somebody who's in charge of midwifery. I heard that called that one time. I just thought I'd use that word. I think he's brought in the leaders, the directors of the programs and all this kind of stuff, and he has said, you do it, because that's the way kings would work. I make you responsible, and if you don't do it, you die. You don't come in and bring in 1,000 people and tell them all. You bring in one or two who are in charge of 1,000 people. You tell them what to do. If it doesn't happen down here, you kill those off and you begin to look down until you find somebody who will do that. This is brutal and this is cruel, but I think that's the way it would have worked so far. And what does he say, the king, to the midwives? This is amazing that the king is saying it directly to the midwives. I want you to take this. The king has taken personal direction of this thing. What does he say to them? If it's a boy, kill the baby at the moment it's born. And if it's a girl, why would you do that? Because we can increase our population with the slave girls. This is not a pretty sight, ladies and gentlemen. This is not a pretty sight. And we have enough of a history in our own country to know something about what this looks like. When you attend Hebrew women in childbirth, that's the first time in my translation it has used the word Hebrews instead of Israelites. It now goes back and forth between those two words. If it's a boy, kill him. If it's a girl, let her live. But the midwives were God-fearing women and did not obey the orders of the king of Egypt, but allowed the boys to live. There's another translation that says they refused to obey. They refused to obey. The king called them on the carpet. Did you notice that in verse 18? What do you mean by allowing the boys to live? And at this point, they either prevaricate or they bald-faced lie. Take your choice. Or maybe it's true, but watch what they do. It's fascinating. The first thing they do is to claim superiority for the women of the Hebrews over the women of the Egyptians. Our women are not like Egyptian women. Did you catch that? You've read this, right? Right? The midwives said to the Pharaoh, Hebrew women are not like Egyptian women. They are hardy and give birth easily and quickly before the midwives can get to them. What does that say about the Egyptian wives? Egyptian women are not hardy and they're not very good at giving birth. Well, there's a case that can be made. That's another road I don't think I want to go down. But yeah, they've been, chances are that either they're dead or they're healthier for having it, the kind of work that they've been doing. Yes, ma'am.
Bill, back in 17, it says that the midwives feared God.
Yes, but they have not stood before the king and said, we fear God and we're not going to obey you. No. That's all I'm saying. Yes. They feared God.
But Pharaoh didn't believe in God. These men have been...
Yeah, but what happens if you stand in front of a king and say, I don't think I'm going to do what you said? Right. And what I'm saying is, I don't know if it's prevarication. Maybe it's true. But it certainly is a beautiful answer. What chance do we have? We're trying. We're trying. We just can't get there in time. These are hardy women, unlike yours. They give birth easily and quickly, unlike yours. And you sort of hear this little put down in their voices, which makes you want to cheer just a little bit for them. Okay? As a result of this, verse 20, God was good to the midwives, and the people went on increasing, and don't miss this, guys. It's not just numerical increase. What else is happening? You have a group of people who are in slavery and they are worked like dogs, and what's happening? They are becoming healthier and stronger by the exercise. The indolence and the fact that the Egyptians were not exercising and working this hard leaves them that if there's a problem, you might be on the short end of things. Since the midwives feared God, he gave them families of their own. I don't know what that means. The implication is they didn't have families of their own before, and I don't know why. I don't know what would have prevented that. And then comes verse 22, and the chapter ends. Pharaoh gave this order. To whom did he give the order?
To all of his people.
To whom did he give the order? Let's just make sure we hear it. To all of his people. Who's that? That's the Egyptians. Throw every newborn boy into the river. Now, my translation leaves out a crucial word. The word Hebrew is not in that sentence, but it sure is implied. But let all the girls live. They're still wanting to take advantage of that. And chapter 2 begins the story of Moses. I see a hand back in the back and then a hand up here back there.
I was just going to say, I think the scary thing is that this has repeated itself in China.
If you do not see modern, not just echoes, but parallels to this, I think you're blind to all that's here. Some of the important things here. You may not be blind to all of it, but you're blind to some of them. These things are happening, and they're happening sometimes by official edict in very direct ways, and sometimes by official edict in indirect ways. But this is part and parcel, and not just on the other side, parts of it on the other side of the world, parts of it here, and parts of it both places. Yes, Jerry?
Is it related to not having a midwife?
You know, if you take a look at verse 15, my translation says the king of Egypt then spoke to the Hebrew midwives. I am assuming, but you are right to question this, I am assuming that it was Hebrew women who were midwives and not women who were midwives to Hebrew women. I don't think these were Egyptian. But if they were Egyptians serving as midwives, that would be fascinating. But I don't think that's what it is. But that's an interesting point to raise. I just don't know. I just don't know.
Well, the other aspect of that is, if you had that order, what you would do is you wouldn't call the midwives to the last minute when it was too late, and the child would be born. You see what I'm saying? In other words, you wouldn't say come a day early or hours early. You just wait till after the baby's born and then call them.
Or you might not call them at all. Or you might not call them at all. Yes, quickly.
I forgot what I was going to say. Oh, with talking about the commanded his people, the Israelites were slaves, so they were his people as well.
Yeah, I think he's giving this. You don't have a slave population if you do not have oversight and control. There are Egyptians who are living with, working with, supervising those, and I think that's the group to whom he was giving that order.
Okay.
Now, I don't know. I don't know, but that's the way I read it.
Because the Amplified Version says, every son born to the Hebrews, you shall cast into the river Nile.
Yeah. And it's the to the Hebrews part that I said, I think that's implied. Okay? Chapter 2. We're going to begin this. Don't know how far we're going to get. We've only got about 45 more minutes. Let's see what we can do. I heard you ran over last week, so you don't mind, right? There was a man descended from Levi who had taken a woman of Levi as his wife. I think that's a beautiful sentence. I don't think that the other translations say the same thing, but I don't think they say it quite as poetically. A man descended from Levi takes as his wife a woman descended from Levi. What was his name? Doesn't say here. It says elsewhere. What was her name? Doesn't say here. Says elsewhere. What were their names? Amram and Jochebed. Amram and Jochebed. Go look it up sometime. You have the impression that they are God-fearing people. They have come from the part of the Israelite community. They have come from that part that God will later give control and leadership in worship to. The Levites will become the worship leaders. And you have a sense that these were people who are in a position that kind of beauty would be something that would both be welcome and that they would do it well. She conceived and gave birth to a son, and seeing what a fine child he was, she kept him hidden for 3 months. What did she see that told her he was a fine child?
It was hers.
Would you say that a little more loudly? Because that's where I went first.
That it's hit her
son. He was hers.
Naturally, she would think he was a fine child.
Mm-hmm. I think any mother would have thought this of a child. I think it would be rare sometimes, but rare when you don't. Moses is her firstborn, right? No. Absolutely not. You haven't read the whole of Exodus. You have not read Exodus. Good heavens, folks. Hang in, guys. Hang in. He has an older sister because the older sister is going to watch in just a few minutes or in 7 days, depending on whether we get through this in the next few minutes. He also has an older brother. Who's his older brother?
Aaron.
How much older is Aaron than Moses?
3 years.
Aaron hasn't been thrown in the river. Aaron's fine. What does that tell you? I'm guessing, but I think it's an educated guess. the edict came within the last 3 years. Aaron and Miriam, they survived the earlier things. Aaron survived the let the midwives kill them. Here comes Moses. And Moses, what's the order? No, what's the order from the king about Hebrew boys? I'm sorry, let's just make sure we rehearse this two more times. What is the order? Throw him in the river. What's the order? Throw him in the river. Did they obey that order?
Yes.
Absolutely.
Yes.
Absolutely. Without question, they obeyed that. They were a little slow in obeying. Okay? When she could hide him no longer, verse 2, seeing what a fine child he was, she kept him hidden for 3 months. How do you hide a little baby? That's tough. That's tough. You get a dog that whines like a baby, and maybe you got a chance. Oh, it's a dog. The dog. The dog makes a noise. When she could hide him no longer, she got a papyrus basket for him. Mine even says the material. Does yours? Coated it with bitumen and pitch. Yours probably says tar.
And pitch.
She put the child inside and laid it among the reeds at the river's edge. His sister took up position some distance away to see what would happen to him. Has she thrown the child in the river? Yes, she has. The fact that it's a basket that is waterproof and floats, King didn't mention that. We have a lawyer here. We have a good lawyer here. Why did they throw the baby in the river at that spot? Well, we could read the next verse and figure that out. What happens? Pharaoh's daughter comes to that spot to bathe. Is this the first time Pharaoh's daughter has ever come to this spot to bathe? Probably not. It is probably known that Pharaoh's daughter comes to this spot. Where did they put the baby in the river?
Well, the river bank and the reeds.
Yes, 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 but where? Just upstream from Pharaoh's daughter, so that the basket would float. And as she's bathing in the river, what's this? And that's what happens. Time out for a minute. Who does it say found the basket? Who went to the river to bathe? Hey, you gotta read this very carefully. What does it say? Over here, what does it say? Are you guys reading this? Don't let these guys out talking. Who was it? Pharaoh's daughter. Who was it? Pharaoh's daughter. What did Bible not say? It did not say one of Pharaoh's daughters. The daughter of Pharaoh, it says in one translation. Pharaoh's daughter, it says. How many daughters did Pharaoh have? I'm taking a guess here. One. Any daddies in the room with daughters? Any daddies in the room with one daughter? Daddy, I found a baby. I want to keep him. What do you say? Kill it. That's what you said. What are you going to do? You're not going to kill it. What does she do? I'm reading ahead a little bit. What does she do? I've just jumped way, way down to verse 10. My translation does not catch this well. It says, Pharaoh's daughter treated him like a son. That's not a good translation. There's better translations out there. What does it say? She adopted him. Yeah. That's the good translation.
So he took the child and nursed him.
Mm-hmm. Now, what happened in between? The daughter, the older sister of Moses is keeping watch. She sees Pharaoh's daughter find it, and she just comes running out. Oh, what you got there? I got a baby. How you going to nurse that baby? I don't know. Would you like me to find you a nurse? Yes, would you? And then she says, oh, let me look. Is there a nurse somewhere? How about you, woman? And who does she bring? Moses' own mother. How long is Moses with his mother? If he's with his mother, he's with his father. If he's with his mother, he's with his brother. If he's with his mother, he's with his sister. If he's with his mother, he's with his family. How long does that take place? We don't know. Take a guess. And don't make it a month. probably 2 years, maybe three, maybe four. And what happens, there are people out there who are despotic in the history of our world who have said, give me a child until he's five and you can do whatever you want to after that. They have some time with that baby in his formative time. He probably learns to speak Hebrew in that time. And he probably learns to speak Egyptian as well, because chances are they know what's coming. And they have a chance to start him and get him started. But we don't have a chance to do any more because we're out of time. Let's have a word of prayer as we go. Our Father, we thank you for the story that's coming, because it's going to both lift us up and accuse us. It's going to both inspire us, and it's going to confront us when we see all the things you're doing through this special person, Moses. Help us understand that what is possible in the life of one baby growing up boggles the mind. But that's the way you often act. We pray that you would help us see the value in all human life, especially today, the value in our own lives, that we can dedicate our lives to you. All this we pray in your Son's name. Amen.